Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot N1BLF. We'll be reading together here on the Courage Handy Hymn System CQ Magazine for the month of November 2010. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hymn System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hymn members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hymns may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyhymn@courage.org. That's in lowercase. Handy Hymn is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. One word, handyhymn@courage.org. We have a fine website that's updated every single day, www.handyhymn.org. And having mentioned handyhymn.org's website, in Ham Radio News, I'll give you the first interesting piece. It's CQ, the magazine unveiling its updated website. CQ Magazine has launched a new and updated website, focusing on a streamlined user interface and greater ease of navigation. The launch completes a company-wide upgrade for the websites of all four of its magazines, which, in addition to CQ, include Popular Communications, CQ VHF, and World Radio Online, which we also share with you here on the Courage Handy Hymn System. The new CQ site features highlights of the current issue and links to selected content, as well as Hamfest and special event listings, easy links to the CQ Writer's Guide, award and contest information, a comprehensive link section, special information for new and prospective hams, and direct links to advertisers' websites, as well as a direct link to CQ's Facebook page, the new craze in computering, I guess. Call sign lookup and a link to the online CQ archives are also available. The CQ website may be accessed at www.cq-amateur-radio.com. Let's get to the other news. Arizona ham, a possible murder victim. A rather ominous start here, huh? The body of a ham from Glendale, Arizona, who had been reported missing, was found inside a box trailer being pulled by a truck, and a possible former business partner is being held in connection with the case. According to Newsline, 30-year-old David Wild, spelled W-I-L-E, called K-E-7-S-W-L, was reported missing August 17 after he failed to show up at an appointment. About a week later, police were alerted to a foul odor coming from the back of a truck with a trailer attached. Upon stopping and searching the vehicle, sheriff's deputies reportedly found Wild's body in the trailer. The driver, 48-year-old David Edison, was charged with concealing a body. Newsline also reports that a woman identifying herself as Wild's aunt alleged in a blog posting that Edison is her nephew's roommate and former business partner. Authorities say more charges could be brought against Edison as they continue their investigation. Our next AM radio news piece, Netherlands Antilles, broken up. In a long-anticipated action, the government of the Netherlands has granted new semi-independent status to two islands in the Netherlands Antilles, and reclassifying the status of the rest of the islands in the Caribbean chain. As of October 10, Curaçao and Saint Martin became autonomous countries within the Kingdom of the Netherlands. That was a quotation. While the islands of Bonaire, Saint Eustatius, and Saba each became, quoting again, special municipalities of the Netherlands, close quote. For more on the impact of this change on Ham Radio DX entities' status, we'll be talking about that a little bit later in this issue. Solar wind around Earth picking up. A new cycle of solar wind activity around Earth is finally starting. According to researchers at Boston University's Center for Space Physics, Newsline reports the conclusions are based on observations of recent auroras. Normally, This increase in solar wind activities accompanies the start of a new solar cycle. But this time around, it had lagged as cycle 24 got off to a slower-than-usual start. This is a good sign for hams, since the increased solar wind activity associated with a rising sunspot cycle is what actually causes improved propagation by interacting with the Earth's magnetic field. Events Warning System for Solar Flares. Researchers at Britain's University of Bradford have developed a method of predicting solar flares up to 6 hours before they occur, and are working on predicting major solar eruptions as well. The energy released by solar flares and storms can damage electrical and communication systems on Earth, with orbiting satellites in particular danger. According to Newsline, the system, dubbed ASAP-4, Automated Solar Activity Prediction, uses three-dimensional images generated by the SOHO, S-O-H-O acronym, standing for Solar and Heliospheric Observatory Satellite, to classify and analyze sunspots and predict when a flare is about to erupt. U.S. supports international MF-HAM allocation. The United States will support creation of an international amateur radio allocation at 461 through 469 and 471 through 478 kilohertz at the next World Radio Communications Conference in 2012. According to the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, the Federal Communications Commission, and the National Telecommunications and Information Administration have agreed to support a secondary amateur allocation on the band, which had been used in the past by ships at sea. Now, in parentheses, 500 kilohertz was long the International Maritime Distress Frequency, close parenthesis, but has been largely abandoned due to the advent of satellite technology. The International Maritime Organization continues to call for no change in allocations on the 416 through 526 kHz band, noting some continuing operations and plans for new uses of the band in the future. The United States portion would protect incumbent users. Canada drops race comms into two ham bands. Industry Canada, that country's equivalent of the FCC, recently required hams in Montreal and Quebec City to temporarily share portions of the 2-meter and 70-centimeter bands with non-amateur communications for a bicycle race. According to Newsline, Canadian officials said the frequencies were authorized to provide communication support for European entrants in the now-concluded event, and were selected to avoid known active repeater frequencies. The Radio Amateurs of Canada called the action highly unusual and a matter of great concern, and planned to take up the issue with Industry Canada officials. Here's some good news. WRTC returns to the United States in the year 2014. The 2014 World Radio Sport Team Championship, WRTC, will be held in New England, the first time in nearly two decades that the prestigious contesting event will be based in the United States. The ARRL letter reports that the U.S. group was selected over a competing proposal from Bulgaria by the WRTC Sanctioning Committee. The last WRTC to be held in the United States was the 1996 competition in San Francisco. Unlike previous competitions, which have been coordinated by radio clubs or national societies, the 2014 WRTC will be run by two individual hams, Doug Grant, K1DG, and Randy Thompson, K5ZD, backed up by a group of 10 directors and approximately 50 additional volunteers. Grant notes that the 2010 CQ Worldwide DX contest, both the single sideband and CW segments, will count as qualifying events for potential WRTC 14 teams. One more piece here at Newsline. 6 meters open to hams in India. The government of India has given hams access to the 6-meter band, permitting operation from 50 through 54 megahertz, with a maximum power level of 25 watts. However, according to Newsline, only FM-based modes, that's F1B, F2B, F3C, and F3E, are permitted. With CW, SSB, single sideband, and other modes either overlooked or excluded. Most long-haul DX on 6 meters is done on CW and single sideband. Let's move along now to Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by the editor Rich Mawson, called W2VU, Whiskey 2, Victor Uniform. This Zero Bias piece is titled The Importance of Unimportance. Often we never know the impact of our actions and decisions on the world around us. Little stuff, mostly. Things that may seem totally unimportant at the time. Author Mitch Albom wrote a book about that calling, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. In the book, the main character doesn't know the impact he's had on other people's lives until his own life is over. But sometimes we do have the privilege of knowing, while we're still here, the effects over time of a seemingly minor action. 40 years ago this month, at the age of 15, I did something that seemed relatively minor at the time, but which has guided and influenced my life ever since. I became a ham radio operator. This is no exaggeration. While I saw this at the time as something to help me get more enjoyment out of the radio hobby, it was already a broadcast and shortwave DXer and CBer, and get my radio merit badge in Boy Scout, I had no way of foreseeing how being a ham would help lead me into a career in journalism, provide me my first unintentional interaction with my future wife, and eventually result in becoming a leader in the hobby itself. But it has done all this and more, all through a series of other seemingly minor but interconnected events. Along with becoming a ham, I became a member of my high school's ham radio club. When the high school in the next town got a license for a 10-watt educational FM station, our principal didn't want to get left behind, so he came to us, since we were the only people in the school who knew anything about radio, to find out how we could follow suit. We couldn't. Too much money involved. But he basically gave us carte blanche to do anything that didn't violate federal law that could still let him say we had a school radio station. So we started up a fake station, broadcasting to a speaker in the ceiling outside our radio room, followed the next year by providing programming to the cafeteria during lunch and over the public address system. Around the same time, our school was starting up a community internship program in which students could spend a few hours each week at a local business that interested them in order to get a first-hand view of how it really worked. One of those businesses was a local AM radio station. Anyone remember local AM radio? I was one of about 24 students who applied for that particular internship and was the only one who got it. I was later told by the teacher in charge that she picked me, quoting, because of how active you were in the school radio station, close quote. I never had the heart to tell her it didn't really exist. That internship led to my doing freelance news reporting for the station, which led me to decide that I wanted a career in broadcast journalism and gave me practical experience to put on my college applications. At college, I continued parallel involvement in both broadcast and amateur radio, working at the campus radio station and co-founding a ham radio club, along with Bob Halperin, now K1XA, who went on to become deputy communications manager of the ARRL in the 80s and 90s. My ham connections got me hooked up with the engineering folks at the TV station, whose transmitter was located on our campus. That, in turn, got me introduced to the engineering director for the Mutual Broadcasting System who was another ham, who hired me to do weekend work as a tape editor for hourly sports broadcasts, and advised me not to get too involved with the technical side of broadcasting, if I had hopes, which I did, of being in front of the microphone instead of behind it. My ham radio activity kept me on good terms with the engineers at radio stations I worked for after college, resulting in a request to bring in a shortwave receiver during hurricanes when I worked on the broadcast desk at the Associated Press to monitor and report on ham activity, and introduced me to Joel Heller, WA2FFI, who would eventually become my boss at CBS News. While working at CBS, I got involved with making promotional ham radio videos and comic books, which is how I met CQ publisher Dick Ross, K2MGA. Dick brought me to CQ in 1992 to produce a series of ham radio instructional videos. That led to working on CQ's 50th anniversary edition in 1995, becoming founding editor of CQ VHF in 1996, and eventually succeeding Alan Dorhofer, K2EEK, as editor of CQ after Alan became a silent key in 1999. Taken individually, very few of these events or actions seemed to be of major significance at the time. But taken collectively, they have all been signposts along the path of my career, and they are all bound together by a decision I made 40 years ago at age 15 to get my ham radio license. Plus, of course, along the way, I've made some great friends through ham radio and have gotten the opportunity to go places and do things which otherwise would have been highly unlikely, from shooting video with Senator John Glenn at the U.S. Senate ham station W3USS, to riding in the lead convoy of the New York City Marathon, to helping provide communications in Lower Manhattan in the aftermath of 9/11 attacks. No other hobby would have provided me with these opportunities. Oh yes, how did ham radio introduce me to my wife? Well, we were neighbors in an apartment complex outside New York City, and the landlady, a wannabe ham herself, allowed another ham and me to put up wire antennas from our apartments into the trees behind our building. One day, one of the wires of my horizontal V-beam sloper dipole, which worked amazingly well, by the way, came down in the wind while I was off working a midnight shift at the Associated Press. I came home in the morning to a downed wire, neatly rolled up, with an unsigned note attached, telling me how I really needed to be more careful with my wires, because someone could get hurt tripping over them. Even though it was many months after we began dating until she finally admitted having written that note, it is clear in retrospect that this was just one more example of ham radio helping to provide a pathway, not only for my career, but for my entire life. As I look back over 40 years in ham radio, getting that novice license back in 1970 was clearly one of the most important, unimportant things I've ever done. 73, W2VU, Rich Mawson. Well, folks, I think it's time now to give you some announcements that are particular to the next month or two, especially for the ham radio hobby, obviously. We'll start off with the Kentucky CUSO party, hosted by the Western Kentucky DX Association. That's going to be November 13 through November 14. Now, the following special event stations are scheduled for November. There are going to be quite a few mentions of Veterans Day here. Bear with me, please. K4NYC from Veterans Day Recognition Day, Coral Springs, Florida, November 11 through 13, on all the various frequencies. K0GRL, from Veterans Day Special Event, Eastern Nebraska Veterans Home, Bellevue, Nebraska. Strategic Command Memorial Amateur Radio Club is November 11th. W0JH, remembering the Edmund Fitzgerald, two stations operating from Split Rock Lighthouse, which, if you're interested in lighthouses, is ARLHS, USA 783, Split Rock, Minnesota. That's being sponsored by the Stillwater Amateur Radio Association. CG3MUG, that's a Canadian call. Thunder Bay MCTS Center, Canadian Coast Guard radio station, regular call sign VE3MUG, celebrating 100 years of radio service, Thunder Bay, Canada, November 2010. There will be several options for amateur radio stations and shortwave listeners to obtain a special 100th anniversary CG3MUG QSL card. A certificate may also be designed. Another special event station, VA3, Victor Alpha 3, India Fox, VA3IF, from Remembrance Day Celebration, McRae House, the birthplace of Colonel John McRae, the author of the poem In Flanders Fields, from Ontario, Canada. The Gulp Amateur Radio Club will have this event on November 6th to November 11th. So it's rather lengthy. You might want to catch them. Here's the following hamfests for the month of November. November 6th, South Florida Hamfest, South County Civic Center, Delray Beach, Florida, Boca Raton Amateur Radio Association. Also on November 6th, Enid, E-N-I-D, Hamfest, Garfield County Fairgrounds, Hoover Building, Enid, Oklahoma. Now on November 7th, WACOM, WACOM 2010 Hamfest. This is from Pennsylvania. Washington County Fairgrounds, Washington, Pennsylvania. November 12th through 15th, the 4th, FENARCOM, F-E-N-A-R-C-O-M, FENARCOM, the Amateur Radio Convention of Brazil. Indaiatuba Municipal Sports Center, Indaiatuba, São Paulo State, Brazil. Now on this particular one, there is no actual frequency given, but if you have access to the internet, you can go to www.fenarcom.br/. November 13, Farah Fest, Upper Cape Regional Vocational School, Bourne, Massachusetts. That fest is being sponsored by the Falmouth, Massachusetts Amateur Radio Club. The announcement here doesn't give you any specifics as to what frequencies they'll be on, but I'm sure you'll hear them if you look around on the East Coast for that Falmouth Amateur Radio Club function there at the Cape Regional Vocational School. If you've never been in this area, folks, I might add just a little bit of color to that. I'm located in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, adjacent to New Bedford, where the largest fishing port in the United States, right here below Boston. And Bourne is about 18, 20 miles from me, as the entranceway to Cape Cod. The location that's given here, the Upper Cape Regional Vocational School, is probably on one of the most beautiful sites of land in the eastern seaboard of the United States. It overlooks the Cape Cod Canal, which is approximately 7 miles long, and just a beautiful view, especially in the summertime when you're up there watching sailboats, tugboats, very heavy tankers, and other commercial vehicles cruise through the Cape Cod Canal underneath both the Bourne Bridge and also the Sagamore Bridge. Now back to reality. November 13 and 14, Fort Wayne Hamfest and Computer Expo. That's being held at the Allen County War Memorial Coliseum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's sponsored by the Allen County Amateur Radio Technical Society. And again in Massachusetts on November 20th, CAARA, Amateur Radio Flea Market. It's being held at Pigeon Cove Circle Center, Rockport, Massachusetts. That's on Cape Ann. It's a Cape Ann Amateur Radio Club sponsorship. Now, I suppose I could add also, if you were doing these things in Massachusetts or New England a month or two earlier, like right now in October, you'd get the fantastic display of autumn leaves. but enjoy the beautiful scenery anyway. For instance, Cape Ann there happens to be very famous, most especially the village of Rockport, for its artist community. Quite a tourist trap as well, I suppose, but it's still beautiful. I'm going now to a featured piece in the magazine from November 2010 for CQ. Mystery Boat Anchors, War Stories, and the Vietnam QRP Crow. The author is Dennis Lacazar, spelled L-A-C-A-R. Dennis's call is W4DNN, Whiskey 4, Delta November. The siren call of a vintage rig often produces more questions than answers about its history. W4DNN tells the story of one such rig and of his own experiences using ham radio knowledge to try to protect villagers during the Vietnam War. I saw her from across the crowded room. She was a knockout. I knew right then that I had to possess her, but my wife had other ideas. I had violated the first rule of Hamfest strategy. Never take the XYL along with you, even if she is a ham. He's referring to his wife Ruthie, K4KLQ. However, there she was, a vintage Heathkit DX40 transmitter, just beckoning me to approach. How could it be that no one had snapped up this beauty? As I rapidly closed the distance between us, her beauty began to fade. Scratches and scars appeared, and horror of horrors, someone had engraved words right into the front panel. This rig had been through a few wars. The inscription was intriguing. Sperry, that's spelled S-P-E-R-R-Y. Sperry R&D, 1500. And there's a picture to show that. Wow, my thoughts raced. What stories could this rig tell? Perhaps it was a part of the Apollo Moon Project. Maybe it tied into research on Cold War spy transmission techniques. And in parenthesis, if anyone knows the story behind this rig, please drop me a line. W4DNN, close parenthesis. And to make it even more enticing, the tag informed me that it had a new transformer and that all the tubes were good. Another voice told me that I must bin on it. Another voice told me, it's ugly, it's dirty, it probably doesn't work, and you're not spending $65 on that piece of junk. But honey, maybe the man will take $50. Forget it. I offered $40. And left the Hamfest with another vintage treasure and a rather irate XYL. You'll see, I assured her. It'll work great. And it did. After replacing the 6146 final tube, a few fried resistors, and an open 40-meter coil, in the following few weeks, I worked quite a bit of DX on 40 and 20-meter CW using the old rig, a Vibraplex bug, and a vintage Hammerlund HQ-126X receiver. I love to tell the other ops that you're working a true vintage station. The transmitter is 50 years old, and the receiver is 65, and the op is 68. That was me. I guess I'll have to find a spark gap to realize the station's substantially older than me. I've always had a fascination with old rigs, especially old rigs with mysterious inscriptions or markings that might indicate an interesting past, like my new slant old DX40. This line of thought takes me back to my own career in electronics in the 1960s. I just finished a four-year enlistment as a U.S. Coast Guard electronics technician. The Guard was, and is so small, smaller than the New York City Police Department, that a tech needs to know how to fix everything. I worked with radios, radar, sonar, and even had a secret clearance to work on crypto. After engineering a 1 megawatt Loran transmitting station for a year, I was able to pass the exam for the FCC first-class commercial license with radar endorsement. Upon entering the real world, I turned down jobs ranging from Spirit Rand ship hull inspection radar equipment maintenance, finds metal fatigue, to TV repair for RCA. I went to work with an engineering team at the Gould Clivett Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio. As a subcontractor to the Apollo Moon project, we were tasked with building test gear to cycle solar cells through the hot, cold, vacuum environment of space. Designed by Cleveside, these were not your ordinary solar cells. They were composed of a thin film evaporated onto a flexible mylar backing. They could be rolled up like a window shade and extended in space. This was groundbreaking in the 60s. Every good thing eventually comes to an end. Shortly after I began working at Cleveside, the announcement came that Apollo was to be scrapped. No more moonshots, no more solar cells, no more work. There must be something else we can use these cells for, management hoped, and I landed a dream job. I joined a team to take ideas from management higher-ups to see if they would fly. Ideas ranged from the divine to the downright dangerous. Solar headphones were fun. Solar toilet seats were nuts. Solar detonators were something I didn't want to fool with. One idea in particular was an ideal project for a ham, a fun project for me. A subheading, the QRP Crow. The Vietnam War was in full swing and there was a problem. Our guys would liberate a jungle village from the Viet Cong. And once we moved on, they would come back, striking at the random one of the areas we had just cleared. The villagers had no way of letting us know until it was too late. Therefore, I was asked to design and build a prototype Vietnam QRP Crow. The idea was that if the villagers learned that the Cong were coming, they could grab a tiny transmitter and throw it up into a tree, just like the call of an alarmed crow. The transmitter would cry out its electronic SOS and our guys would come running. Batteries were not a good option since they were heavy, and it might be months before they would be used, not reliable. Enter the roll-up lightweight Mylar solar cells. I wanted to design a tiny QRP transmitter that would operate from solar power. I would equip it with a bunch of fish hooks and, when thrown into a tree, the Mylar cells would blend with the foliage. The crow would be unobtrusive, but, unknown to the invaders, would be calling for help as long as daylight lasted. Many things that would be a breeze today were real challenges in the 60s and before. I was raised on electronics with things turned rosy red and flashed blue, heated up the shack, and could pack a wallop that would send a careless ham across the room at 75 miles an hour. This newfangled solid-state stuff was a whole other world. When hams of the 60s thought QRP, we envisioned something like a Benton Harbor lunchbox, the venerable little Heathkit HW29-6, the Tenor, or the Tour. There are photos of those folks. These little 5-watt rigs had transformers, 5 tubes, and weighed in at a hefty 7 pounds of joy. To address the challenge, I began by bringing my old novice receiver to the lab. The National SW24 was just the thing for receiving the treetop SOS that I hoped would result from my work. I installed a long run of coax from the lab to the far side of the building so that my receiving antenna would be some distance from the tiny transmitters. The Crow's circuit would have to perform two functions. First, of course, it would have to transmit at an adequate power level with an inadequate voltage current level. Next, it would have to generate a signature signal that would function as an unmistakable SOS. In addition, the package needed to be nearly invisible, but it also had to be a good target. Once the village was secure, the troops needed to silence the bird without climbing the tree. One shot should take it out. One final requirement, also like a bird. It had to be cheap, cheap, cheap. So work began. A good starting point for an up-and-coming radio designer might be, yes, the ARRL Radio Amateur's Handbook. Right there, I found a simple but elegant circuit for my bird. A one-transmitter grounded emitter circuit that gets its feedback current from inductive coupling. The RF frequency is determined by a traditional tank circuit. Current fed back from the emitter to the base through L2s and C2 and sustains oscillation. To begin the project, we only needed to create a unique signal that would let the local area monitoring station know that it was a crow he was hearing. RFD, that's radio direction finding, would have to pinpoint the source village. Phase 2 might be to encode a unique ID for each village, but first things first. To make the signal distinctive, I could switch the oscillator slant transmitter on and off at an audio rate, resulting in a tone heard at the receiver. The switching circuit, as I remember, was very simple. Again, I used a simple one-transistor circuit in which the transistor was driven back and forth between saturation and the cutoff, resulting in a square wave output. Placing this circuit in the supply to the oscillator transmitter, we had a simple audio rate pulsed signal output. Perhaps the frequency of the tone could even identify the village, and there were many possibilities. The prototype had come together nicely, and the spring-loaded quick-release mechanism could quickly allow the solar cells to unroll and the fish-hook-ended antenna wire to deploy. The crow was ready for its acid test. I called a meeting of the team as well as the corporate executive who had come up with this eureka thought. We created a jungle environment in the corner of the lab using pieces of the prior year's artificial Christmas tree. The fluorescents were our daylight sun, a big heave-ho, and a bird was in the tree. From across the room, the SW24 let out an angry buzzing tone that set the observer's hair on end. It was a beginning. Now, the happy ending to my story? I never completed that project and never learned of the fate of the Vietnam QRP crow. There is an old saying that if you can't do it, write about it. So, with the engineering field hemorrhaging jobs, I interviewed as assistant editor for a nationally circulated engineering trade magazine. Having several ham radio and other published technical articles under my belt, I convinced the publisher to hire me on a trial basis. My career as an editor, writer, and eventually a publisher had begun. The rest is a long but exciting story that I must save for another time. Suffice it to say that today, late into the long, cold Florida nights, when the frigid winds rattle the windows, at age 68, a 65-degree wind is frigid. Where's the Bengay, honey? I left the fire up the old DX-40 and the HQ-129X, warming to the glow of their tubes. And if the night is really cold or the band is really dead, I will turn on the old Heathkit SB-200 amp, cruising the bands with vintage space heaters. Now that's ham radio heaven. Well, that was a very nice nostalgia piece going down memory lane for a lot of us, I suppose. The author again was Dennis Lazar, L-A-Z-A-R. His call is W4DNN, Whiskey 4, Delta, November, November. Thanks a lot, Dennis. Fine work. Next up, we have one of those really important announcements. The 2011 CQ Worldwide 160-meter contest. The dates for the CW, or Morse code portion, 2200 Zulu, January 28 to 2200 Zulu, January 30, two solid 24-hour periods. For single sideband, 2200 Zulu, February 25 to 2200 Zulu, February 27. Again, two 24-hour solid periods. The 2009 rules reflected several significant changes, and we are repeating them here as a reminder. Following is a summary of those changes. 1. The start and end times of the contests has been shifted 2 hours earlier in response to requests from the 160 contesting community. 2. The exchange for DX stations has been changed from RST, if necessary on the T, and country to RST and CQ zone. 3. A new single-operator slant-assisted class has been added to permit the use of clusters, skimmers, etc. 4. A 40-hour maximum operating period has been added for multi-op entries. 5. Provisions have been added regarding remote operation. Now, those of you who are into 160 meters or a lot of other ham activity, of course, can understand what these various repeats of the 2009 rules are all about. And obviously, the announcement here is to warn you or to alert you to the fact that it's coming in January, which is only about 6 or 8 weeks away now, and February. Now, the objective for amateurs around the world is to contact other amateurs in as many United States states, Canadian provinces, and countries as possible, utilizing the 160 meter band. Now, as regard to band use, it's 1800 through 2000 kilohertz. All entrants are encouraged to spread out as much as possible, obeying frequency restrictions and power limits for their own country. And the article goes on to talk about all the various categories, single operator, QRP, multi-operator, and so on. So if you are interested or plan to be into this in a big way coming up in January, you should perhaps get a copy of this edition of CQ Magazine for November 2010. The announcement for the worldwide 160 meter contest begins on page 32, goes through page 33. And as usual, good luck to all of you, because there are a lot of hams throughout the world getting themselves all warmed up for this 160 meter event. Having just talked about that 160 meter contest, which is in January and February, two different parts of it, of course, there is an article here on contesting as such by John Doerr, spelled D-O-R-R. John's call is K1AR, Kilo 1 Alpha Romeo. Can contesters be nice guys? And here's November's contest tip. In a multi-op station setup, it can be highly motivational for the team to have a multiplier bell at each operating position, the sort that used to sit on hotel check-in desks. Each time you work a mult, sound the bell. It puts a smile on everyone's face. During the opening hours of the contest, it may not help, as mults enter the lot quickly and the bell will sound a lot. However, in the closing hours, mults may come only few and far between, so it can really lift spirits to hear the bell. If it's a CQ worldwide double mult, you hit the bell twice quickly, and the team usually cheers loudly. Before beginning this month's discussion, I'm afraid that I have to admit my own guilt regarding many of the following scenarios. Unfortunately, a strong argument can be made that the contest community as a whole is losing its friendly demeanor, at least in some cases. The issue at hand is our operating practices. I'd like to break up our operating techniques into several categories and leave you thinking about how they apply to you. Hopefully, you'll feel as determined as I have become in helping clean up our operating habits in the heat of battles. Subtitle here, the W4 Tango Station Go Ahead. How many times have you heard a DX station say, the W4 Tango Station 5936, followed by three or four stations in another call area dumping in their calls? For example, Kilo 2, whatever? The excitement of the moment often gets the best of us. I equate this scenario to someone calling your number 23 ticket on the service desk intercom of a car dealership and experiencing six people with other numbers running to the desk to try and beat you out. Skilled operators such as contesters are better than that. Yet, at times, we don't put our best foot, mouth, or paddle forward. Now we go to the subcategory Bravo, Bravo. Ah, yes, sending just the last two letters of your call sign. Or was it the first three? Year of birth? Zip code? Few know where this silly operating technique originated, and many more know where they would like it to go. Although the temptation to go on a rampage here is extreme, the simple fact is that in nearly every case, signing the last two letters of your call sign in a pileup slows down the other operator. There is nothing more frustrating during a fast run than to have a 59 plus 40 station cover a pileup with the pronouncement Alpha Bravo, requiring you to ask for an unnecessary fill of his call sign. My good friend Jim Nager, N6TJ, among others, has taken a fairly extreme position on this style of operating and simply won't respond to stations that don't sign what's printed on their license. Now, regarding calling, this is a special favorite of mine, and we've all done it. Recall those 20-meter pileups when a rare multiplier shows up at the end of the contest for the first time? And then there's that classic 28504-like fracas with WB5XYZ slant HR2. Sometimes contesters get carried away. We become so focused on working that double multiplier that we call and call and call again. The fact is that many DXations can't handle it. I spent some time this past month asking some casual DX stations about the troubles they encounter while operating contests. Unlike the hardcore contester, many stations in rare DX locations have turned on the radio, unknowingly finding a DX contest in progress. The attempt they make to work guys and gals under those conditions is largely to provide a service to the serious operator. In their minds, this activity could just as easily be replaced by a trip to the local beach. Now, you know that one about, is the frequency in use? I recently read an article detailing the history of telephony, AM, and single sideband. In particular, the author speculated as to the content of the first phone message. That's voice message. Although none of us will ever know for sure, he was quick to point out that we can assume history's second transmission had to be frequency is in use. Another favorite comes from years past when Bill Giotta, K2EK, defined QRL as warning. I will be calling CQ in approximately 30 nanoseconds. Oh, well, simply put, how much do we really check to see if the frequency is in use? The approach to this point varies from 1 to 2 digits on CW to 3 to 4 honest attempts for ownership on single sideband. The result is that there is often at least one ensuing battle in each contest with someone who thought they were on the particular frequency first. And so on. Now for some final comments. It's going to be an interesting time for contesting in my part of the world over the next few years. In case you haven't heard, New England, that's W1 Land, has been recently selected by the World Radio Sport Team Championship, WRTC. You might recall, folks, I commented about that in the news at the beginning of this recording. Sanctioning committee to be the host location for WRTC 2014, led by Doug Grant, K1DG, and Randy Thompson, K5ZD. There will be much more said about this event in the coming months and years, but suffice it to say that the tradition of WRTC, that's the World Radio Sport Team Championship, will live on and is in good hands. See you in the next contest. 73 John, K1AR. You know, it seems that a lot of the reporting from this end anyway today in the November 2010 issue of CQ Magazine has been about the contesting. Well, here's another slant on that subject, the propagation. It's in an article by Thomas Hood and W7US. High frequency HF radio enthusiasts celebrate the arrival of the winter DX season. From October through November 2010, we will see a steady improvement in the DX bands. During the CQ Worldwide contest taking place in both months, we should experience fairly good success. The 2010 CQ Worldwide CW contest will start at zero Universal Time Constant, that's UTC, Saturday, November 27, and run through 2359 UTC Sunday, November 28. Looking at the 27-day rotation of the Sun, taking into consideration the current solar activity at the time of writing this column, which was sometime in perhaps mid-October, I suspect, expect conditions to be comparable with conditions of the 2004 or 2005 contest weekend. The best tool available to predict HF propagation conditions in advance is the 27-day recurrence tendencies of geomagnetic, solar, and ionospheric conditions. It is not an absolute method, but it does give a very good indication of what is expected. Predictions for one 27-day rotational period are far more accurate than for three 27-day rotational periods. Be sure to carefully check conditions on October 31st and November 1st, since this will be one rotation period before the CW contest weekend. There is better than a 90% chance that conditions observed on those days will recur during the November contest weekend. The author, Thomas Hood, goes on at some length reporting on the various bands, 160 meters, 80 meters, 40 meters, 20, 15, 10, and so forth. And also gives a lot of tips on the CW operating for contests. He gives information about the VHF conditions, and he finishes up with the current solar cycle progress report. The author welcomes your thoughts, questions, and experiences regarding this fascinating science of propagation. You may email me, write me a letter, or catch me on the HF amateur bands. It's signed 73 Tomas, NW7US. I think we'll finish up today with a little bit of a piece from Washington Readout. The author here is Frederick O. Maia, M-A-I-A. His call is W5YI. The article is titled Complying with the FCC's RF Safety Regulations. One of our readers wanted to know about the RF, that's radio frequency safety statement that all amateur radio operators sign whenever they apply for or renew their amateur radio licenses. That statement appears in the fine print in the certification section of all amateur radio applications. It simply says, quoting, I certify that I have read and will comply with Section 97.13C of the Commission's rules regarding radio frequency, RF, radiation safety, and the amateur service section of OST slant OET bulletin number 65, close quotations. The writer said that no one had ever explained this to him, and he wanted to know what it was all about, exactly what he was agreeing to and what he had to do to comply. We also have had several other questions sent to us pertaining to RF exposure. While we have covered some of this before, this month let's go more into depth on RF safety as it applies to the amateur radio hobby. First, a little history. Here's the background of RF safety rules. Radio waves are forms of electromagnetic energy that are collectively described as radio frequency, or RF. RF can be propagated through space in the form of electromagnetic fields when supplied to an antenna. The most important use of RF energy is in providing telecommunication services to the public, industry, and government. It has been known for some time that high intensities of RF radiation can be harmful due to their ability to rapidly heat biological tissue. The FCC is required by the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969 to evaluate the effect on the human environment in RF radiation discharge into the air from FCC-regulated transmitters. Guidelines were adopted by the Federal Communications Commission in 1985 to establish safe RF exposure limits. Under these original guidelines, amateur radio was specifically excluded from the FCC's RF radiation safety rules. The reason was that due to relatively low power and duty cycles, ham radio transmitters were found to be safe under the 1982 Protection Guidelines for RF Exposure issued by the American National Standards Institute, ANSI. As the 1980s progressed, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, IEEE, developed a new, more stringent standard for RF exposure. This represented an abundance of caution rather than a response to any newly identified threat. In 1992, ANSI adopted the IEEE exposure standard as an American national standard. The following year, the FCC proposed to update its rules and adopt the new ANSI/IEEE guidelines, which were developed by panels of scientists and medical experts to protect human beings from known harmful levels of exposure to RF fields. In the Telecommunications Act of 1996, enacted on February 8, 1996, Congress required the FCC to complete updating its RF safety rules, quoting, regarding the environmental effects of radio frequency emissions, close quote, within 6 months. A week before the deadline, on August 1, 1996, the FCC revised and updated the maximum permissible exposure, MPE, criteria, the field strength and the power density, for transmitters operating at frequencies between 300 kHz and 100 GHz. Power density is defined as power per unit area. The FCC concluded ham radio stations under the new guidelines for the first time. Since, quoting, amateur stations can transmit with up to 1,500 watts peak envelope power on frequencies in specified bands from 1,800 kHz to over 300 GHz. Certain of the emission types permitted have high duty cycles, for example, frequency or phase shifted digital signals. And amateur stations are generally not subject to restrictions on antenna gain, antenna placement, and other relevant exposure variables. The regulations affecting amateur radio went into effect on January 1, 1998. The maximum permissible exposure, that's that MPE thing again, limits vary with frequency, since scientific data has shown that the human body absorbs RF radiation at some frequencies better than at others. As a general rule, the higher the frequency, the greater the energy content and potential for damage through heating the human body. Research indicated that RF energy is soaked into the body more readily at frequencies between 30 MHz and 300 MHz. And folks, I'll sort of leave it at that. A lot of that is really rather technical. I suppose you've gathered that if I haven't put you to sleep already, but it's really very important, obviously, because it has to do with federal regulations. Suffice to say, if you're an amateur radio operator or you're training yourself to pass the test and become one, you really should have someone slow you down and help you understand how to fill in that form relative to RF. Radio frequency propagation. Well, that just about brings me up to time for this month's reading of CQ Magazine for November of 2010. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta, My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're about 50 miles south of Boston, right on Buzzards Bay near New Bedford, the good old gateway to Cape Cod. Thanks again. Have a great Thanksgiving holiday and a future for December as well. 73s from N1BLF.